You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Ace the day. After a wild card entry to Wimbledon last summer, Emma Raducanu clinched a U.S. Open singles title, sparking a career whirlwind and a Dior beauty role. One calming strategy is to center your breathing, the 19-year-old says, a tall order amid full-court sprints. Her daily routine is an anchor to From Breakfast to Face Wash by Laura Regensdorf. Rise and shine, 7:30 a.m. My electric toothbrush was a bit of a hassle to travel with, so I went manual. 8 a.m. I go to bed thinking about breakfast. I love smoked salmon. Greek yogurt is great. I try to set my day up with fruits, protein, and some carbs, especially because I'm working out. 8:30 a.m. I take probiotics because gut health is big for me. I've definitely noticed a difference with my skin and general mood. 9:15 a.m. Dior Addict Lip Glow gives me just a bit of life. Court time, 11 a.m. On my body, I use a Super Goop SPF spray. I don't want the grease on my hands because it's tough to hold the racket. 12 noon. I find myself training in all white by accident, but I've stuck to that. Unwind, 6 p.m. Because I'm an athlete, I obviously sweat a lot. La Mousse Off On really refreshes my face. 6:30 p.m. Showering for me is quick. Aveda shampoo has always been in the family. 10:30 p.m. I make sure to put my phone away. I feel like it keeps your brain wired and active. 11 p.m. I'm on the hunt for the best pillow, but I like a silk pillowcase. It's really nice on my face. Russian dolls. The West fairy tale fetish is rooted in capitalist fantasy, by Rachel Dodes, with an opening illustration by Bill Donovan, which depicts well-dressed women walking down a red carpet, emerging from a horse-drawn carriage. You perhaps already know the story of supermodel Lena Permanova. In case not, here's a summary. When she was a teenager, Permanova was facing 6 years in a Siberian prison for selling ecstasy at Russian nightclubs, until her dad asked Alexander Lebedev, a former KGB operative turned billionaire, for his help in her case. He helped, and by the time she was 18, Permanova and Lebedev, 27 years her senior, had fallen in love. A Cinderella story was the Harper's Bazaar headline. 20 years later, Permanova is a mother of four, philanthropist, and world-renowned fashion influencer with 2.4 million Instagram followers, an Insta-hero, as Tatler magazine put it. Other Russian models have followed a similar arc. Irina Shayk was heralded as the coal miner's daughter in the pages of V-Man magazine. Going from life as a simple farm girl in nowhere Russia to a global celebrity. By nowhere, they meant Emanuelsk, a small village close to the Kazakhstan border, where Shayk planted potatoes in her garden until she was discovered one fateful day. She became the first Russian featured on the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, and later had a baby with Bradley Cooper. Natalia Bovdianova's incredible career trajectory, from selling fruit on the streets of Nizhny Novgorod to becoming the face of Calvin Klein and marrying a British aristocrat whom she has since divorced, earned her the nickname Supernova. Her star still burns bright. In 2020, she married Antoine Arnault, son of one of the richest men in Europe. Sasha Pivoravova was an art student in Moscow who didn't aspire to be part of the fashion industry until her photographer boyfriend, now husband, sent her picture to IMG. She opened the Prada show 2 weeks later. "It's hard to imagine a more meteoric rise," gushed the website The Fashionography. Is it, really? Since the early 2000s, when Vladimir Putin came to power and transferred vast quantities of wealth into the hands of loyal Kremlin-linked oligarchs, beautiful women from Russia and former Soviet bloc countries have been branded with a strikingly similar narrative. A Cinderella story in which capitalism arrives as Prince Charming. Strange as it may seem to think there are trends in human beings, there was a moment in the early aughts, around the time George W. Bush looked Putin in the eye to get a sense of his soul, when it felt like runways were a continuous parade of tall, thin, and steely-eyed Russians with names like Vlada, Natasha, and Irina, following in the footsteps of Natalia. At the same time, wealthy Russian shoppers began populating those front rows. By 2012, the New York Times style section declared that the Tsarinas are back in a piece about how Russians were becoming designers' most important couture clients in a generation. We are primed to devour these rags-to-riches stories because they seem ripped right from the pages of Russian literature. Who among us hasn't been moved by the doomed passion of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, the ill-fated extravagance of Chekhov's Lyubov Andreyevna, or the tragic sensuality of Dostoevsky's Nastasya Filipovna? On TV, we were delighted by the seduction of beautiful KGB agent Elizabeth Jennings, Carrie Russell, by the West on The Americans. In The Great, Hulu's comedic reinterpretation of the life of Catherine the Great, we scoffed at the debauchery of Imperial Russia while rooting for our heroine, Elle Fanning, to overthrow her boorish husband and unleash the Enlightenment across the land. On and off the fashion runways, the luxury-clad women were, in most cases, unwitting props, in a narrative that put a glamorous spin on Putin's global kleptocracy, allowing him to cultivate the image of a leader restoring Russia to its former glory, even as the money backing him was undermining democracies around the world. The fetishization of Russian women extended beyond the fashion industry, of course. We need look no further than rhythmic gymnast Alina Kabaeva, hailed by The Guardian as one of the new Russian divas in 2007. Raised in Tashkent, in northern Uzbekistan, Kabaeva was reportedly deemed to be too fat for gymnastics until a notoriously tough coach put her on what she has described as a near-starvation diet and an intense training regimen, which earned her Olympic gold, the title of Russia's most flexible woman, and, following her retirement, a parliamentary seat in the State Duma and a reported $10 million a year job atop a pro-Kremlin media company. By 2011, she was on the cover of Russian Vogue, wearing a gold Balmain gown and fending off continuing rumors that she was Putin's girlfriend. Recently, she was reported to be holed up in a Swiss chalet with her four children, believed to be fathered by Putin. Putin refuses to speak about his private life. When Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, Milan Fashion Week happened to be underway. As a result, runway models, both Russian and Ukrainian, were some of the earliest and most visible critics of the war. Ukrainian model Kristi Ponomar held a Prada bag as she gave Putin the middle finger in an Instagram post on the day of the invasion. Another Ukrainian model, Katerina Zub, protested outside the Dolce & Gabbana show holding her country's flag. Vodianova posted links to charities and wrote on her Instagram that my heart goes out to all mothers who are suffering the consequences of recent events in Ukraine, but was called out by commenters for not explicitly saying the word war. Shaik, in contrast, posted a peace sign and said no to war, but closed the comments. Vlada Roslyankova, who identifies as a supermodel and Siberian princess in origin on her Instagram account, posted a video of herself singing a Russian song. Permianova posted an all-black square on her grid with a broken heart emoji saying, in Russian, we want peace. Some designers went out of their way, making moving exhibitions in solidarity with the Ukrainians. During Paris Fashion Week, the fashion house Balenciaga left blue and yellow T-shirts on the seats of every showgoer, along with a heartfelt note from designer Demna Vigelia, who became a refugee when he fled Georgia as a child. In Milan, Giorgio Armani turned off the music and had models walk in silence as a sign of respect to people in the unfolding tragedy. Ukrainian designer Dima Ivienko of the brand Inky Inky found himself stranded in Italy just a day after he showed his fall-winter 2022 collection. In an interview with GQ, as he scrambled to help his 120 Kyiv-based employees, he said he felt that the industry wasn't doing enough to acknowledge the enormity of the situation. The largest country in Europe is under huge, violent attack from Russia, and still nobody knows and nobody cares. He had a point. The symbolic gestures of support were all taking place as luxury goods were largely left off of the EU's Russia sanctions. They were added a couple of weeks later. As NATO countries work to seize yachts and untangle the international holdings of Putin-enabling oligarchs. The glamorous mythology is being punctured before our eyes, and Western democracies are discovering that the call is coming from inside the house. When Evgeny Lebedev, with whom Permanova jokes about being his stepmother, even though he is several years older than her, was elevated to Britain's House of Lords in 2020 by Boris Johnson, despite reports that intelligence officials raised concerns that he might be a security risk, Lebedev posted a photo of himself in a crimson velvet robe decorated with white fur on Instagram. "Musique amongst the noblemen," the caption said. Calling himself a musique, which is defined as a Russian peasant, was a bit of a stretch, but it was in keeping with the narrative that even the oligarchs like to attach to their personal biographies. A recent profile in Town and Country featured the headline, "The Dizzying Social Rise of Russian Scion Evgeny Lebedev." Asked whether he had intervened, Johnson denied it, arguing that the question suits Putin's agenda to try to characterize this as a struggle between the West and Russia. His answer, perhaps unintentionally, revealed how entangled Western democracies are in Putin's dirty money, how we've masked a sinister reality by telling ourselves these ridiculous fairy tales for way too long. Now, here's this month's cover story. The Rebellion will be televised. With a fleet of new shows on the horizon, Disney is vastly expanding the Star Wars universe. Vanity Fair dives deep into the multi-year plan and assembles the stars who hope to do for streaming what George Lucas once did for movies. By Anthony Bresnikan, with exclusive photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photos, Darth Vader. In the new show, Obi-Wan Kenobi, the Lord of the Dark Side, hunts his old mentor, setting up their fateful confrontation in 1977's Star Wars. Reva the Inquisitor. Moses Ingram co-stars as a fearsome exterminator of Jedi, wielding a double-bladed spinning lightsaber. Obi-Wan Kenobi premiered May 27th. Obi-Wan Kenobi, in the eponymous new show, Ewan McGregor reprises his role as the younger version of Alec Guinness's wise old man, now in exile in the desert. Mon Mothma, in Andor, Genevieve O'Reilly's galactic senator secretly leads an uprising against the Empire. Cassian Andor, Diego Luna stars as a man who believes in nothing, but eventually risks everything to aid the rebellion. Andor premieres late summer 2022. Dean Djarin, Pedro Pascal's bounty hunter, also known as the Mandalorian, has such an orthodox devotion to his culture that he only takes off his helmet in dire circumstances. Season 3 of The Mandalorian returns in late 2022 or early 2023. Ahsoka Tano, Rosario Dawson's alien warrior, is deeply attuned to the Force, but some fans call her a gray Jedi because she doesn't commit to absolutes like her brethren. Ahsoka is scheduled to premiere in 2023. Diego Luna couldn't trust the driver. He didn't think he could trust anybody. And hadn't he read something about an epidemic of eavesdroppers hacking phones? That was just my paranoia, the actor says now, not connected to reality. Still, he pressed his phone so tightly to his ear that it made his face hot, as a voice from thousands of miles away told him secrets from another galaxy. The car was stuck in traffic on the top tier of a double-decker highway in Mexico City. I was speaking in code words because I was trying not to say too much in the car, says Luna. The words he was avoiding most strenuously were star and wars. Luna had played the dauntless rebel spy Cassian Andor in the 2016 film Rogue One. Now, on the other end of the phone, was Tony Gilroy, who had punched up the movie's script for reshoots. Gilroy, whose credits include writing the first four Bourne thrillers and writing and directing Michael Clayton, was developing a series that would explore Andor's backstory, revealing what drew him into the Galactic Rebellion and how he evolved from a self-serving nihilist into a selfless martyr. Luna's call with Gilroy, the first time he heard the full plan for the Andor story, happened more than 3 years ago. One thing I remember from being part of this since day one is how little you can share of what happens, says the actor. I have kids, man. It's painful for them and for me. George Lucas himself had attempted and abandoned a live-action Star Wars series called Underworld, before he sold Lucasfilm to the Walt Disney Company in 2012. Scripts were written and test footage shot, but the level of quality he was looking for proved to be too expensive for a TV budget. Then, in 2017, Lucasfilm was tasked with trying again, this time making not one series, but a whole fleet to bolster its parent company's streaming ambitions. Disney Plus would need the firepower of many Star Wars shows to compete against rival titans like Netflix and Amazon. The Mandalorian, we know now, became a global phenomenon, which only raised expectations. This winter, The Book of Boba Fett delivered a redemption story nearly four decades after the title character's apparent demise in Return of the Jedi. Now, with 130 million subscribers waiting, Disney has upped its demands to three separate Star Wars shows within a year. For this story, Lucasfilm has lifted the secrecy surrounding its TV universe and how it formed, as universes do, under immense pressure. First up is Ewan McGregor's return to his role as a weary Jedi Master in Exile. Obi-Wan Kenobi debuted May 27th, tracking the character 10 years into his time on the desert world of Tatooine, where he serves as a distant guardian to young Luke Skywalker and is hunted by a dark side inquisitor named Reva, played by the Queen's Gambit's Moses Ingram. Luna's spy saga Andor hits screens late this summer. Season 3 of The Mandalorian, reuniting Pedro Pascal's helmeted gunfighter with his little green ward, you know who, drops in late 22 or early 2023. Next year, Rosario Dawson will lead the series Ahsoka, playing the live-action version of a fan-favorite Force wielder from animation who was once an apprentice to Anakin Skywalker. Slightly further off is The Acolyte, with a tale set about a century before the era of the Skywalkers. It's a bountiful time to be a Star Wars obsessive, to say the least. McGregor, who wrestled with joining the galaxy in the late 90s and wrestled again with whether to return, says the gig has saturated his life. My partner, Mary, is doing that Star Wars series with Rosario, and she's about to start, he says. Lucasfilm hadn't previously confirmed rumors that Mary Elizabeth Winstead will be in Ahsoka, but now they don't have to. Our little boy has been born into this massive Star Wars family, says McGregor, whose son with Winstead was born last summer. He will either embrace it or really go the other way. I don't know. Maybe he'll be a Trekkie. On that day, in mid-2019, when Luna was recruited for Andor, the actor remembers looking out the car window at the rooftops of the adjacent buildings, visualizing the tale about resistance-minded spies and a near-death escapes. He was especially glad that Gilroy's proposal included details that resonated personally. Luna describes Andor as a refugee story, with desperate people fleeing the Empire at the full force of its power. It's the journey of a migrant, he says. That feeling of having to move is behind this story, very profoundly and very strong. That shapes you as a person. It defines you in many ways and what you are willing to do. Gilroy breathes deep and reveals a little more about Andor. This guy gave his life for the galaxy, right? I mean, he consciously, soberly, without vanity or recognition, sacrificed himself. Who does that? He asked. That's what this first season is about. It's about him being really revolution-averse, and cynical, and lost, and kind of a mess. The story begins with the destruction of Andor's birth world. Then follows him into adulthood when he realizes he can't run forever. His adopted home will become the base of our whole first season, and we watch that place become radicalized, Gilroy says. Then we see another planet that's completely taken apart in a colonial kind of way. The Empire is expanding rapidly. They're wiping out anybody who's in their way. By journey's end, Andor's path will be to block theirs. The show also focuses on the enigmatic rebel leader Mon Mothma, played by Genevieve O'Reilly, who portrayed her as a young senator in Revenge of the Sith, then reprised the role in Rogue One. Mothma, then played by Caroline Blakiston, was the priestess-like figure in 1983's Return of the Jedi, who outlines weaknesses in the new Death Star, gravely intoning, "Many Bothans died to bring us this information." In Andor, her story will run parallel to the title character, whom we know will eventually become one of her key agents. "It is a huge, orchestral, Dickensian ensemble cast," says Gilroy. Luna remembers the conversation in the car as the moment he was all in. "At the end, Gilroy said to me, 'You want to take this risk with me, man? It's you and I from beginning to end,'" says the actor. "It was like you'd been recruited to join a rebel force. I was like, 'Yes, of course, man, yes.'" Then reality set in. "What did I just say? This will be happening in London? My life is in Mexico. Holy shit, what have I done?" It's the theme that binds all the new shows: devotion. What's unique about Star Wars is that we're one story, basically, says Lucasfilm president Kathleen Kennedy. George was always dealing with episodes. Ironically, he was serializing his storytelling. He was influenced by Flash Gordon and cliffhangers on Saturdays at movie theaters. All of that informed what the DNA of Star Wars is, which is why I think it's just organic that we made the transition into television. The transition was not an obvious pivot for an empire built on movies. When she took over Lucasfilm in 2012, Kennedy's primary goal was to rejuvenate Star Wars with a new era of films, after a trilogy of prequels that underwhelmed many fans. Few producers were better poised to do that, given her legacy of crowd pleasers, ranging from E.T. to Back to the Future and The Sixth Sense. By the end of 2015, Han, Leia, and Luke were back on the big screen in J.J. Abrams' The Force Awakens, which introduced the desert scavenger Rey, the redemption-seeking stormtrooper Finn, the X-wing hotshot Poe Dameron, and the brooding Sith wannabe Kylo Ren. Ryan Johnson's sequel, 2017's The Last Jedi, continued the Skywalker saga, as it came to be known, but veered sharply from Abrams' vision and seemed to close off some central storylines. Abrams U-turned back when he returned for 2019's final chapter, The Rise of Skywalker, taking over Episode 9 late in development. The movies all earned billions, but the zigzagging narrative was conspicuous. All this led to the hiatus, a fallow spot in the Star Wars film landscape that Kennedy announced in early 2019, months before The Rise of Skywalker even debuted. Lucasfilm needed to regroup and rethink. We all recognized, every single one of us, that this was a new chapter for the company, and that we needed to all work together to create the architecture for where we were going. Factor in the standalone movies Rogue One and Solo, and the Bay Area production company had been churning out a blockbuster a year, a breakneck pace, considering that Lucas himself only released one Star Wars film every 3 years, with well over a decade between trilogies. Kennedy wanted to dispense with the annual deadline and reconsider everything. The most important lesson they'd learned was this: Star Wars required a greater degree of professional devotion from filmmakers. Anyone who comes into the Star Wars universe needs to know that it's a 3, 4, 5 year commitment, she says. That's what it takes. You can't step in for a year and shoot something and then walk away. It requires that kind of nurturing. getting something appropriately cosmic prepped for their streaming services launch became Disney's highest priority. It had to feel as big as the films. So Kennedy turned to a filmmaker. Jon Favreau had inaugurated the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Iron Man a decade before and was steeped in large-scale serialized storytelling. The actor and director had also become so proficient with visual effects that his most recent Disney projects, The Jungle Book and The Lion King, were often mistakenly described as live action, even though both are almost entirely digitally simulated. I knew that Jon Favreau was always deeply interested in Star Wars. He was the first person I went to, Kennedy says. He said, not only would I have an interest, I have an idea. Plus, he was willing to meet that new criteria of hers. What's unique about Jon is his commitment, Kennedy says. He's had a sole focus pretty much on this for the last several years. That's been a godsend. After meeting at Kennedy's office in Santa Monica, Favreau started work without even a contract. I just started writing, he says. So by the time I was officially hired, I had already written the first, I think, 4 episodes. But there was a problem. Favreau's idea was about a Mandalorian, the helmeted tribe of galactic warriors who frequently turn up as mercenaries or bounty hunters. The first, and for a long time the only, Mandalorian in the early Star Wars films was Boba Fett, and Lucasfilm planned to make him the central character in a feature film being developed by director James Mangold. That wasn't the problem. Although Favreau would eventually pick up the Boba Fett story after Mangold moved on to another Lucasfilm property, directing Indiana Jones 5. The problem Kennedy faced was that another esteemed creative executive, Dave Filoni, had also devised a series focused on Mandalorians. Filoni is the colorful cowboy hat-wearing mastermind behind many of Lucasfilm's animated shows. He joined the company in 2005 as an apprentice to Lucas himself and developed The Clone Wars with him. Filoni wanted to explore some of the ideas they'd never fully realized. I remember when I did Clone Wars, George came in and said, "Well, the Mandalorians are pacifist in this time period." I'm like, "Oh, well, that's very different than what everybody thinks they were." And he was like, "Well, you've got to remember that people are never just one thing. Cultures evolve, and they change over time." Being able to channel the creator makes Filoni indispensable at Lucasfilm. He was a critical part of the company's new TV ventures, and Kennedy had been nurturing his filmmaking ambitions ever since her arrival. Favreau and Filoni were friendly, but Kennedy feared a turf war might erupt. She devised a fix. "I arranged a playdate," she says. After meeting in Los Angeles, Favreau and Filoni exchanged ideas and drawings for a Mandalorian show that could combine their ideas. They got along instantly, like gangbusters, Kennedy says. Filoni's knowledge of Mandalorian history blended with Favreau's lone gunslinger concept. Next photo, Cape Fear. Hayden Christensen, who reprises his role as Anakin Skywalker, now Darth Vader, trains for a lightsaber duel with McGregor's stunt double, Ross Konstam. Most importantly, the new partners challenged each other. Favreau's idea for the child was the biggest sticking point. "It gave us some pause," Kennedy says. He and Dave debated that quite ferociously. The child, of course, is the pistachio-hued scene stealer who would melt the Mandalorian's icy bounty hunter heart by becoming the innocent he must protect at all cost. The little one remained under wraps until the debut of the first episode, then instantly became an object of global adoration. His real name is Grogu, but on our world, he is forever Baby Yoda. Honestly, it's something I never would have done because Yoda is Yoda, Filoni says. Yoda's home world and backstory were never fully revealed, and Filoni wanted to protect the mystery that Lucas built around the original Jedi Master. I think people now look back and think it was like a slam dunk, but we were very cautious, Filoni says, of the child. The amount of measuring, especially in the first season, for how we were framing this kid took a lot of effort. The pair spoke with Vanity Fair in a joint Zoom interview, and as Filoni described his initial reservations in one window, Favreau disappeared from another, rustling through papers and returning with sketches and drawings of Mando and child. One of them, drawn by Filoni himself, showed the baby's hand reaching out of a floating bassinet toward his burly protector. Most of the other concepts were off-putting, wrinkled, feral, or cartoonish. It's easy to understand Filoni's hesitation. There were a lot of different looks that popped up, and then we got one that finally clicked. It's this drawing, Favreau says, taping a full-color concept image by artist Chris Alsman, now emblazoned on countless pieces of merchandise. In it, the child sits in a bulky brown onesie with wide doe eyes and a slightly derpy expression. That's him, this one, Favreau says. He had kind of a goofy, ugly look. We didn't want him too cute. Part of his charm is that you feel a little pity for the guy, like Chaplin's Tramp or Charlie Brown. There was never an alternate creature suggestion. It's not like we might have gotten a crustacean-like Baby Ackbar on lunchboxes, dolls, backpacks, and T-shirts. And we may never have gotten a child at all if Lucasfilm hadn't solved another, even bigger problem with The Mandalorian. How to create a show that goes to new worlds in every episode without the back-breaking budgetary demands of shipping a crew to the farthest reaches of our own planet. We were making series that were meant to sit alongside our films with a third of the budget and half the time, says Carrie Beck, a development and production executive at Lucasfilm who co-executive produced The Mandalorian. While it became a huge success, I feel like everybody's blood, sweat, and tears are on that screen. Ironically, the thing that cleared their path was a wall. The cluster of bulky beige buildings in Manhattan Beach, a South Bay community near Los Angeles, looks as boring as any warehouse district. They are the khaki pants of architecture. Inside, at least two of these sound stages, however, are portals to other worlds. After The Mandalorian debuted in late 2019, Lucasfilm's special effects division, Industrial Light and Magic, began to reveal details of the colossal curved LED wall they call the volume that can envelop a film crew as effectively as any location shoot, generating an environment that's convincingly photorealistic, even to a digital camera. There's no need to ship a crew and props and actors anywhere. Everywhere can be brought to the studio. With three volumes now in L.A., one in London, and one in Vancouver, film and TV creators are just beginning to discover its capabilities. The glow of dusk or dawn can last the whole workday if necessary. You can freeze the sun. Or if you're shooting something set on Tatooine, you can freeze two of them. Back in 2018, when The Mandalorian was first being planned, the tech was unsteady. Richard Bluff, supervisor of ILM's environments departments, had spent much of his career building virtual backdrops and knew the volume, which ILM officially calls stagecraft, could be just what the Mandalorian needed. Without it, the show would either be too costly to produce or too chintzy to impress. The turning point came in the spring of that year, when one of the most famously exacting directors of all time stopped by. James Cameron came to visit, Bluff says. He was next door working on the Avatar sequels in his water tank. John had asked for us to display on the monitors the test we'd shot earlier in the day. This footage featured a Mandalorian stand-in pacing around the dilapidated ruins of an abandoned building, littered with debris and stained by water damage, with walls peeling like dead skin. The structure really exists and sits on Angel Island in San Francisco Bay, but the building's location had been scanned and imported to the LED screens, and the bounty hunter and his mirror-like armor seemed to have been transported into a decaying room. If anyone on Earth could see the seams of the effect, it would be Cameron. I remember distinctly Jim taking off his glasses and leaning close to look at the quality of the image and how convincing it was, Bluff says. I think, for everybody, that afternoon was the eureka moment because it was working. 4 years later, the volume is an essential everyday tool. During a visit in mid-March, it conjures a rocky gray cavern with cliffs embedded with large tech components. Whatever this place is, it's been colonized. On the flat ceiling of the studio, you can see the craggy roof of the cave, with a rough opening that lets light pour down from a circle of blue sky. There's less clutter than other sets, and virtually no dust. There's no smell of fresh paint, sculpted foam, or freshly cut lumber. The volume has the sterile ozone scent of a Best Buy, as millions upon millions of tiny light-emitting diodes embedded in the curved surface evoke alien landscapes. Favreau shows off the stage like a man opening the hood of a newly restored classic car. Ask if the technology allows them to make a full season of television in the same amount of time as a Star Wars or Marvel movie. Favreau shakes his head. No, it's like half the time. One of the first outsiders to see the volume was Pedro Pascal, when the actor was recruited by Favreau to lend a flinty presence to the Mandalorian's anti-hero. I knew that it was an ace in the hole. I just knew, Pascal says, and I haven't been surprised by any of it. Maybe I've been a little surprised by how compelling the Mandalorian can be, because he's spaceless. But that had been a selling point for him, too. The character, later revealed to be named Din Djarin, is such a hardline devotee to Mandalorian rules that he scrupulously keeps his helmet on in the presence of others. That means Pascal can sometimes play the role as a voice actor, while a stand-in wears the armor, which frees him to accept other projects. Maybe I'm a little bit of a commitment phobe, he says, because the coolness of it really excites me, and the lifespan of it really intimidates me. Star Wars actors tend to become Star Wars actors for life. In the late 90s, this led McGregor to agonize over playing the young Obi-Wan Kenobi in the prequel movies. I really questioned it a lot, he says. I felt like I was part of this new wave of British cinema, really, and that Star Wars wasn't me. That's not what I stood for. I was the sort of urban, grungy, independent film actor. The late Sir Alec Guinness notoriously looked down on the space saga when he played the wise old man in the original films. McGregor says he did, too, especially after his first installment, 1999's The Phantom Menace, suffered punishing reviews. It was hard because it was such a huge decision to do them, such a big event. It was quite difficult for all of us to deal with that, also knowing you've got a couple more to do. McGregor was relieved to put the franchise behind him, but in 2017, he was invited to the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood for a marathon screening of every Star Wars film. They asked me if I would want to introduce one, and I've never done anything like that. But suddenly it just struck me that I really did want to, McGregor recalls. Why had his feelings changed? I don't know, he says, scratching a scruffy cheek. I really do think it has to do with growing up. He enjoyed seeing people in sleeping bags, pulling an all-nighter with his movies. Kids who'd grown up with the prequels weren't as cynical as the critics. A few reviewers had even begun to reappraise them. People loved him as Obi-Wan, which made McGregor realize that he did too. After the screening, McGregor started to get asked the question nearly every time he gave an interview. Would he ever consider playing Obi-Wan Kenobi again? McGregor always answered in the affirmative, which is good politics, but not a contractual obligation. The only time the question really mattered was when McGregor was asked by Lucasfilm's then-head of story, Keri Hart, about 4 years ago. She just said, "We just wanted to know if it's true. You've said you'd do it again. We want to know if you mean it," McGregor recalls. And I said, "Yeah, I do mean it. I would be happy to do it again." Lucasfilm intended to make Obi-Wan Kenobi as a movie, to be directed by Oscar nominee Stephen Daldry. McGregor would be a producer this time, giving him more say over the story. I just said, "I think that it should be a story about a broken man, a man who's lost his faith," he says. He always has a funny line to say, or always seems to be calm, and is a good warrior or soldier or whatever. But to see that man come apart and see what gets him back together again, that's where we started. When the Obi-Wan film later evolved into an Obi-Wan TV series as part of Lucasfilm's new yearning for Disney Plus content, Daldry departed, and Deborah Chow, a director from The Mandalorian, came aboard with the goal to keep the series cinematic in scope. There remained one missing component. McGregor's prequel co-star, Hayden Christensen, had been Anakin Skywalker to his Obi-Wan. Brothers in arms, until their brutal battle on a lava flow in Revenge of the Sith. Still, in the early iterations of the Obi-Wan in Exile story, Vader wasn't included. It's an ongoing conundrum at Lucasfilm. How much should they showcase legacy characters, and how much should they keep them in reserve? Would introducing Vader to a story about Obi-Wan's exile detract from their fateful meeting on the Death Star in 1977 Star Wars, when Vader strikes down his old friend? Or could a previously unknown encounter actually enhance that moment? We have these what-if conversations 24/7, says Michelle Rejwan, an executive producer of Obi-Wan and one of the company's lead development chiefs. It's fun to, in your head, pursue the Star Wars or peruse the Star Wars toy store. Oh, we could have this character or feature that ship, but at the end of the day, we really need to keep it pure about why. In the fall of 2019, Chow sat in Christensen's living room. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.